What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Suffering from seasonal irritants? As the pollen count rises, support your immune system with Quiksilver Scientific Cystaid, a targeted blend of nutrients and botanicals designed to help maintain healthy histamine balance and everyday comfort. Quiksilver Scientific Cystaid works with your body's natural response to seasonal environmental challenges, so you can feel your best all season long. Get 10% off and free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. Again, that's tryqs.com/podcast for 10% off and free shipping. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today is an episode of the Weekly Docket where we recap the headlines in true crime for the week. I've got a bunch on the docket for you guys, and I'm doing something a little bit new. We're going to just test it out, see how this goes, but many of you might know that I have a Facebook page called True Crime Kelly, and every day, almost every day, I post various headlines throughout the week, just things, stories that catch my eye, stories that people have recommended to me either through my website, mamamystery.com, or through like the instant messenger feature on Instagram or Facebook. And so that is what I intend to include on the weekly docket, are those stories. But the thing I'm going to try that's a little bit new is basically the response from people who engage with those posts on Facebook and or Instagram or even TikTok, because sometimes I post videos on TikTok, although that's not as frequent. But anyway, so the goal here is to basically include you guys in the conversation. I want to hear your thoughts on some of these stories. So I post these stories to my Facebook page on a pretty frequent basis. So if you ever do want to kind of get on there, see what we're talking about, you can find me at True Crime Kelly on Facebook. Anyway, without further ado, let's get into the weekly docket. We've got a lot of stories to cover. The first story I'm bringing to you is actually kind of close to my neck of the woods in West Des Moines, Iowa. I mean, I don't live in Iowa, but it's like Midwest. It doesn't matter. Anyway, a cold case that went unsolved for nearly 15 years has finally led to an arrest. Authorities say Kristen Elizabeth Ramsey, who is 53 years old, has been charged with first-degree murder in the 2011 death of Ashley Oakland, who was a 27-year-old realtor who was killed while she was hosting an open house. Now, according to investigators, the case dates back to April 8th of 2011, when Ashley was working inside a model townhouse in West Des Moines. Police say someone nearby heard a disturbance and went to check on it, finding Ashley lying on the floor with gunshot wounds. She had been shot twice and later died at the hospital. Now, at the time, investigators believed the killing was not random. There were no signs of forced entry or robbery, and Ashley, like I said, was working this open house, so she likely would have let the person inside herself. Maybe she recognized them or was just expecting visitors. Now, Ashley had also sent a normal text message just minutes before the shooting, suggesting that whatever happened was either something that escalated quickly or took her completely by surprise. The case went cold despite hundreds of interviews and thousands of leads over the years. And now, nearly 15 years later, a grand jury indictment has led to Ramsey's arrest. Investigators have confirmed that Ramsey previously worked for the same home builder that is connected to the property where the murder happened, although authorities have not explained how that ties into the case. Now, at this point, police have not released a motive. They have not confirmed how well the two knew each other, if at all, and have not disclosed what evidence led to the arrest after all these years. As of right now, Ramsey is being held on a $2 million cash-only bond as the case moves forward, and the investigation is ongoing. Now, at the time of the shooting, their age difference was about 10 years apart, and a lot of people are assuming that the motive here was jealousy, that she got replaced by a younger, more attractive lady and maybe just didn't approve of what was going on. Maybe insecurity kind of got a hold of her. And, you know, greed obviously breeds some of the worst in people. And so when I look at the comments on the Facebook page of this, it does seem like most people are kind of assuming that this stemmed from jealousy. One person, Val Walders Gregory, commented that they live about 45 minutes away from where this happened and has several friends in the real estate industry, which definitely makes you feel for their safety. And this is not the first story that I've heard about this, something like this happening, where there was basically conflict or, you know, jealousy or greed, whatever, among real estate agents. There was another case. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, I just did a quick search. And yes, Beverly Carter was a 49-year-old realtor who was showing a home when she vanished. She had gone alone to meet a client who contacted her about this property, but it was all along just a setup, and a couple had targeted her because she was a realtor working alone. So she was kidnapped, she was held for ransom, and she was ultimately killed. And I think that might be one of the most common or like popular, I guess, stories that people think of when they remember a realtor killed during a showing. Another case like that was Lindsay Buziak from 2008. And this took place in British Columbia. She was 24 years old. She went to show a house to a couple who had contacted her. And these clients used fake identities and seemed oddly specific about the property. Anyway, she ended up being found stabbed to death inside the home during a showing. And there's other similar incidents, but essentially, gosh, I think it's scary enough working alone as a female, especially when you're showing homes to complete strangers. I mean, there's got to be some good safeguards in place, and I'm sure that there are. I'm not familiar with the real estate world, but stories like this definitely make you, you know, want to carry brass knuckles and maybe some mace in your pocket. Austin goes, brass knuckles. I don't even know where you would, I don't know why that came to my mind. I just think brass knuckles would be pretty effective in an altercation. Okay, moving on to the next story. I keep getting sidetracked. The next story comes out of Charles County, Maryland, where a quadruple amputee cornhole player has been charged with murder. And no, I did not stutter. This guy has no arms or legs. I mean, I guess he kind of has arms and kind of has legs, but like no hands and no feet. And somehow shot a gun at somebody and killed them. I mean, this story is really very bizarre. Authorities say Dayton James Weber, who was 27 years old and a quadruple amputee who gained attention for competing at a high level in cornhole, where you toss the bags. Everyone probably knows what cornhole is, but in case you don't, it's that game where like you throw the sandbag at a board that has a hole in it and you try to get the sandbag in through the hole. Anyway, apparently this guy was really good at it, and he has since been charged with first and second degree murder in the death of Bradrick Michael Wells, who was only 27 years old. Now, according to investigators, the incident happened the night of March 22nd while Weber was driving with Wells and two other people in the car. Police say an argument broke out inside the vehicle, and during that argument, Weber allegedly pulled out a gun and shot Wells twice in the head. After the shooting, investigators say Weber pulled the car over and asked the two passengers to help remove Wells's body from the vehicle, but they refused. So those passengers then got out and flagged down help while Weber allegedly drove off with Wells still inside of the car. So a short time later, a resident in Charlotte Hall, Maryland, called 911 after they found a body in their front yard. The body was later identified as Bradrick Wells, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Investigators tracked Weber to Charlottesville, Virginia, where he was located at a hospital and taken into custody. He is currently being held as a fugitive from justice while authorities work to extradite him back to Maryland to face charges. Obviously, the top question here is how would he pull a trigger and drive at the same time if he doesn't have hands? I mean, it seems silly and crazy. I mean, people are like, wait, what did I just read? Yeah, I know. It sounds crazy. And there's a picture that I posted to our Facebook page that shows him holding a gun with his arms. I don't know. I don't know how it happened. I wasn't there. I can't even begin to understand. I'm just sharing with you the facts of the story. So that's where we are. Next, we are going to Florida, where a woman is charged with murdering her boyfriend and burying him in her backyard. So this is Bay County, Florida, and on March 14th, a missing person report was filed for Joseph Eiler, who was 38 years old, after his father last heard him arguing with his girlfriend, Ashley Averett, who was 32 years old, at about 4 a.m. on March 12th. And after that, nobody could reach Joseph, and he failed to show up for his work shifts, which was totally unlike him. So investigators met with Ashley, and she said, you know, yes, they had an argument that morning, and he left with an unknown friend. Why is that always their go-to? He left with an unknown friend, so basically the buck stops here, and I can no longer help you, a la Chris Watts, or whoever else that, you know, tries to say, oh yeah, the person that you're looking for, they left with someone. I don't even know who they are, but yeah, I'm the closest person to them. So yeah, it does not make any sense. And I'm sure that raised red flags. But Joseph's father also shared with investigators that he had observed Ashley burning a fire pit in her backyard. And at one point, I guess Ashley asked somebody, I don't know if it was a friend of hers or the boyfriend's dad. It would be kind of crazy if it was the boyfriend's dad, but she asked someone how to dispose of ashes from the fire pit and also refused to allow Joseph's dad in parts of their home. When he went into the home, he noticed that things weren't as they were supposed to be. There was a gun that was like placed in a weird spot, like not where it's usually found, apparently. There was freshly disturbed soil in the backyard. The place, it looked like she was, you know, hastily trying to clean up. And so when investigators returned to Ashley's home to ask her some more questions, she finally admitted that she shot Joseph Eiler while he was asleep and then attempted to dispose of his body. But she also admitted to dismembering his body and scattering the pieces in various parts of the yard. So she has been charged with one count of open murder. The details are one open count of murder. And so what that means in Florida is that basically this is obviously a murder case, but we're not locking into the first degree or second degree version of murder yet. So it's basically, it gives the state some flexibility as they kind of decipher what exactly this whole case looks like, where the evidence kind of leads and takes them. Obviously, this is all still very early in this story, so we'll see where this goes. Now, the next story I'm bringing you is actually insane, and it's out of Maryland. Somebody sent me this story through my Facebook page. Two teachers from Laurel Highlands High School were arrested within days of each other for separate incidents involving inappropriate relationships with their students. In response to these arrests, the school board held a special meeting where they voted to fire one teacher and suspend the other. So the first teacher here is Martin Gatti, or Gatti, it's G-A-T-T-I. He is a social studies teacher and was arrested on March 19th and charged with attempted institutional sexual assault, corruption of minors, and unlawful contact with a minor. Investigators allege that he had called a female student into his classroom back in January and asked her to kiss him and then told her to shut the door before he asked her, "Are we gonna do it?" When the student asked him to clarify what he meant, Gatti responded, "What are we doing?" The student said that a friend of hers was coming. And so apparently this frustrated Gatti, quote unquote, because it is illegal regardless of the victim's age or consent because of his job. So that is like the frustration that he apparently expressed to this victim, because that was in quotation marks. But most importantly, is that the student provided an audio recording of the entire encounter to police. Amazing, amazing that the student had that frame of mind and bravery to do that. Now, he has been terminated from his position. He was released on a $40,000 unsecured bond, and we'll see what ends up happening. But more people, because of this brave student, have come out to speak about some injustices that are going on in this school. So the other case is regarding Daniel Cervone, who is a JROTC instructor at the same school. And he was arrested on March 24th and charged with institutional sexual assault, corruption of minors, and unlawful contact with a minor. State police state that Cervone admitted to a sexual relationship with a student that occurred between 2019 and 2020 when the victim was only 15 years old. The victim reportedly came forward after seeing the news of Gotti's arrest. And so Cervone was held in Fayette County Jail without bail following his arraignment. He has been suspended from his job pending further review. But worth noting is that a separate investigation occurred back in February of 2023, also involving a math teacher identified as Kolasar, K-O-L-A-S-A-R. This investigation concerned an alleged inappropriate relationship between the teacher and a student, which led the district to conduct an internal investigation before involving the state police. And at this point, I think just shut the whole school down. What is going on with these teachers? If you have one bad teacher, I mean, that's a bad enough look. But to have three investigations on teachers acting inappropriately with their students within the span of 3 years, shut the school down. All right, moving on. This case has been taking social media by storm. We have to talk about it. I've been asked a lot about it, whether it's just my thoughts on it or just wanting kind of an explanation of this story. Even Austin, who is like pretty removed from true crime and like trending topics or celebrity gossip, even he was like, who is this tanker Frankie Paul, Taylor Frankie Paul person? Okay, so let's talk about it. What's happening right now between Taylor Frankie Paul and Dakota Mortensen did not just start this year, and that's what's important to start out with. The situation that's unfolding now is actually tied to a relationship that's been volatile, very public, and now under some pretty serious legal scrutiny. So let's talk about it. Taylor first gained attention as one of the original faces behind something called Mom Talk, which was basically like a hashtag. And it was a group of these Mormon moms from Utah who gained viral attention after Taylor revealed during a live video stream that she and her then husband were part of a soft swinging group with other couples in their friend group. So just to kind of back up a little bit, this group of these moms would get together and basically just post videos of them doing like popular dances on TikTok. And in their captions, they would always caption like hashtag mom talk. And they kind of just created this movement or this idea, this brand, I guess, if you will, of these Mormon moms who were doing these dances. And of course, they're all beautiful and they're skinny and they have their hair done. And it's just like, it's a whole brand. So when she came out and said, hey guys, actually we are, some people in this group are part of a soft swinging situation, it kind of blew up on social media. She said that there were some agreed upon boundaries, like no going all the way, but apparently things crossed a line when she admitted to breaking those rules with one of the husbands. So one of the main couples that was tied to the situation was Miranda McWhorter and her then husband Chase. Now Miranda is on Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, which is a show on Hulu. We'll get to that in a second. Miranda's still on there. Chase makes an appearance every once in a while. But another couple that came up later was McKenna Gibbons and her husband, Braden Rowley. And Braden is actually the one that Taylor admitted she crossed the line with, which broke the rules of this agreement. So that admission really blew up their friend group, and it led to multiple relationship breakdowns and ultimately ended her marriage, like Taylor's marriage, to Tate Paul. And it's what first put her and that entire group on the map pretty publicly. So the drama played out on TikTok, and it later evolved into the hit show The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives on Hulu. So now that that's out of the way, after her divorce, Taylor began dating Dakota Mortensen in 2022, and the relationship quickly became a central part of her online presence. The two were very on and off, but they eventually did have a son together in 2024. So a little about Dakota before he met Taylor. Dakota is from Utah. He is a part of the same general social circle and environment as Taylor, which is how they ultimately crossed paths. Before their relationship went public, he was living a pretty low profile life, like not an influencer, not tied to Mom Talk, not really in the public eye at all. Now, Dakota has openly talked about having a history of substance abuse and legal trouble before he met Taylor. So from what's been shared publicly, he struggled with an opioid addiction, specifically pain pills. And I think he has admitted to using heroin in the past. But he has referenced being in a pretty dark place during that time and has said that he has gone through rehab and recovery before meeting Taylor. He has framed that part of his life as something that he turned around before entering the relationship. And regardless of literally anything else that we have to say about either Taylor or Dakota, period, I have to extend kudos to him for that, because addiction is a gnarly beast. My mom died from it, so I have a soft spot in my heart for people who are able to overcome it, just because I know how impossible it can feel for a lot of people. So anyway, moving on, he worked in sales and construction-related jobs, nothing that was celebrity-facing. And from everything that's been shared, he didn't have any kind of online following or platform before he met Taylor. But even before any legal issues, people close to the situation had already described their relationship as intense and unstable. Everything really started to unravel in February of 2023. That is when police were called after an argument between Taylor and Dakota turned physical. Now, according to investigators, Taylor allegedly hit Dakota, put him in a chokehold, and threw metal chairs at him during the altercation. One of those chairs reportedly struck Taylor's daughter, and officers on scene identified Taylor as the primary aggressor, and she was arrested on multiple charges, including aggravated assault and domestic violence in the presence of a child. So later, Taylor entered a plea in abeyance, which allowed her to avoid jail time as long as she complied with probation. Then fast forward to March of 2026, and that 2023 incident suddenly became front and center again, because a video from that night surfaced online showing Taylor throwing chairs while Dakota was present and a child could be heard crying nearby. The video is really hard to watch. If you haven't seen it, I would warn you that it is hard to watch, but they are clearly fighting and she is trying to grab his head. At one point, she grabs him in a headlock and has him like in a chokehold kind of. She can be seen picking up these metal bar stools and launching them at Dakota. You can hear her daughter in the background screaming, "Mommy," and crying. It's painful to watch. So after that video came out, the fallout was immediate. Her upcoming season of The Bachelorette on ABC was pulled just days before it was set to air, and then filming for The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives was paused. Now, at the same time that video was making headlines, a new situation had already been developing behind the scenes. And so there's kind of two camps of people who believe why this came out at the time that it did. You have some people who believe, based on watching the show, that they have a dislike and a distrust towards Dakota because he would keep secrets from Taylor and he would allegedly sabotage like these big moments in Taylor's life through the show. So based on like what people have seen in the show, they believe that Dakota did this in a vindictive way because he wanted to sabotage her premiere on The Bachelorette, okay? Very toxic relationship, that's undeniable. But then you have another camp of people who believe that this actually surfaced because literally just last month, in February of 2026, there was another domestic incident, alleged against Taylor. And so apparently they were in a car together and she became violent towards Dakota and he filed a police report against her in that case. And now a third allegation is being reported from Dakota stemming from an incident back in 2024. So I know it's all confusing because we're kind of jumping around. It's like 2023, then 2026, then 2024. Like we're all over the place. But because from that 2024 incident, Dakota contacted the West Jordan, Utah Police Department with allegations of domestic violence against Taylor stemming from an incident back in 2024. But the source that, released this information to TMZ added that he could not provide further details, citing that it was still an open investigation. And he said that the department was reviewing multiple videos connected to the alleged event to figure out details and timelines. So that spokesperson said that he could not share the exact dates of that 2024 incident. Now, okay, let's pause for a moment to just talk about the details of this video, as well as the body cam footage that has been released by TMZ literally just one day ago, or at least that's the video I'm looking at, on TMZ Clips. And this is their YouTube channel. So here's the thing. The video is an hour and a half long. I am about 24 minutes into it and I'm going to finish it, and I might have to just like come back next week to kind of recap what I think about the video, but I'm kind of short on time today. So I'm going to give you what I have so that I can get this episode out there for you guys. But I'm 23 minutes into this video, and here's what I can tell you. Police showed up because the neighbors of Taylor and Dakota — this is Taylor's house, but Dakota was, you know, there — the neighbors reported that they were hearing screaming and fighting and what sounded like a garage door opening and shutting a bunch of times, and a female voice saying, "Let me out," or "Get off me," or something to that effect. That's what I'm seeing reported, okay? So in the body cam footage, I'm going to tell you just what I observed, okay? So you could probably say this is like kind of based on my own opinion and observation. So the police go up to the door. The second they open the door, you can hear Dakota and Taylor fighting behind the door. The door opens, and right in front of the cops, Taylor swings at Dakota and hits him. And he's basically trying to defuse the situation, telling her to calm down. Dakota's telling the cops she is hammered. And the cops immediately separate the two. So they take Taylor outside first. So that's the footage that you see first, is the body cam footage of her interview on the front porch. You've seen clips of this. Important to say clips, because, you know, clips don't provide the full context, obviously, and this video is an hour and a half long. So anyway, you see Taylor on the front porch talking to this cop. It's painful to watch because it's just heartbreaking. You can tell that she is just in a storm of pain. And that alone is sad and painful to watch. I don't wish that type of pain or anything on anybody. It's very clear that she is highly intoxicated. She's kind of hyperventilating. She's crying. It's like a very guttural cry that she has on this front porch. So you can tell like things have gotten way out of control. And now, you know, she's trying to talk to this cop. So she basically tells the cop through a lot of like broken speech, because she is so drunk and upset, that she has a lot of pain, that Dakota picked her up from her girls' night, that she was having fun with her girls, that he was supposed to go to a concert, they got into a big fight, and now that's where they are. So then it kind of pans over to the interview with Dakota inside the house. The police officer that's talking to Dakota, you know, asks him for his version of events. Dakota is sober. That's one thing that I think is just so important to note here, is that in this incident, Dakota is sober and Taylor is highly intoxicated. Dakota's telling them that he went out with his friends. He was supposed to go to a concert. She was out with her girlfriends. He told Taylor he was going to go to this concert, and Taylor said, "I want to go to the concert with you." So Dakota picks her up from the girls' night, and they have to go back to Taylor's house so that she can get her ID so that she can get into the concert. But when he picks her up, he sees how intoxicated she is and says basically, like, "You can't go like this. Like, it's already late in the night. Let's just go home." And he basically says he doesn't want to take her because she's too drunk. And she just starts kind of going off. Apparently, her family was at the house, either house sitting or watching her young children who were there in the home at the time. And this big fight ensues in front of her family. He alleges that she threw either his phone or her phone on the ground, and it like kind of shattered or just kind of like made this explosion in front of her family, that she was talking all kind of nonsense and that none of it was really making sense. And that the worst part of all is that this was all in front of her children, and that her young child, who I think was only 4 or 5 at the time, was on the couch during this physical altercation. He does admit that he tried to separate himself from her, so he pushed her away from him, and that she like stumbled back, but he's alleging that she fell because she was so drunk and that he was just trying to protect himself. He is the one with the visible like marks on his body, and he does have the footage on his phone. It's the same thing that we see now on TMZ. Like, it's the same video, but he's showing it to the cop that he's talking to. That, you know, this is what I was dealing with. Now, just removing myself from this whole thing, like, one of the things I keep seeing people talk about is that Taylor was suffering from reactive abuse, that Dakota has abused her for so long that her abuse is actually stemming from the abuse that he caused her. But, you know, here's the only thing I have to say about it. And this is kind of my own opinion. You know, I've been in a relationship that was very toxic before with someone who struggled with alcohol at the time. And I am not proud to like say this, but there were times when I would get physically violent because I was just so like aggravated and frustrated and just in so much pain, you know, because of where I was in my life. And this is like my young 20s, probably about the same age that Taylor is in these videos. Now I'm 37, almost 38. So I have like a different perspective on situations and I have more grace for things now. But I say this because I've been in a similar place as Dakota and Taylor. Like, so I'm speaking from my own personal experience from both sides. There is no excuse to put your hands on someone else ever, period. There's no excuse for it. To do it in the presence of children when your child is screaming mommy and is upset and scared, it just, it provokes something in me that is like just very upsetting. It's just very upsetting to watch it. And it is hard to have sympathy for someone who is acting this way in front of a child. So I will just say that. I mean, that's like my human response, okay? The other thing I will say is that the fact that Taylor is completely, you know, intoxicated and that Dakota is completely sober, just kind of gives you context that I think is important because, you know, obviously alcohol can make you do really crazy out-of-pocket things, and that's not something that should be judged. You know, like Taylor, what's her friend? Jessie just went on a podcast recently and said she doesn't like to judge people in their lowest moments. And I think that that is so perfect for this particular situation. I don't want to judge Taylor for this particular instance, but in this video, Taylor appears to be in the wrong. And there are a lot of people who are defending Taylor and saying that this is all because Dakota has provoked her to act this way, and that this is all a culmination of abuse that was brought on by Dakota. Well, my response to that is that if you're only basing that off of what you've seen on a reality TV show that strings together clips to create an entertaining show for the drama and the toxicity, and you're not, you know, seeing that through that lens, then I just think that's kind of irresponsible and naive to believe that you understand the dynamics of somebody's relationship because of what you see just on television, without seeing this hour and a half long body cam video, especially. So that's my first point. But my second point is that if the roles were switched and Dakota was the female and Taylor was the male, what would the reaction be? If you had video of a man throwing a stool at a woman, do you think there would be people out there saying, well, she provoked him? I mean, yeah, you would, but they would be chastised. It would be a completely different reaction. So I don't know. I just think the double standard here is kind of crazy. And I think that, you know, we should be looking at this through a broader lens, like with more open eyes. Look at the body cam footage. I implore you to go watch the full video. I'm gonna watch the rest of it, and I will watch it with an open mind, knowing that my opinion of this story could be completely different when we come back next week. So that's kind of my opinion on the whole thing. Now, as far as the rest of the facts of the case, Dakota has since taken legal action, filing for and being granted a protective order and custody of the son that Dakota and Taylor share, who is named Ever. Important to note, Ever is their son. He was actually conceived after this event took place. So after this big altercation in 2023, they stayed together and then they had a child together. So I'm telling you, they're like off and on quite often. So anyway, he has gained custody of their child, at least temporarily. His side has suggested that there have been multiple incidents and that his focus is on safety and stability going forward. Reports indicate that more than one incident may have occurred over the course of those February days, like just last month, but also now there's this investigation in 2024. Now, Taylor has also responded publicly, but more carefully. She has said that this is a heavy time and that there is more to the story than what people are seeing online. She has confirmed that the two are no longer in direct contact and are instead communicating through a third party when it comes to their child. Her side has also suggested that the relationship has been complicated for a long time and that the full context has not been made public. So there's obviously things that we don't know about, and maybe those things will come to light. I think it's interesting that Dakota has this footage, but there's been no other footage that might be owned by Taylor. Like, who knows? Taylor might have footage of Dakota that is, you know, going to be upsetting to watch, and who knows if that will come out or not. But as of right now, all we have to go off of is what we see on this Hulu show and a body cam footage. So I don't know. I almost feel like talking about this is kind of like a waste. Like, it, you know, having an opinion about this is kind of a waste because, again, we just don't have all the information. So as of now, filming for The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives has been paused, and some cast members have publicly said that they were not comfortable continuing production while everything was still unfolding. Multiple cast members have spoken out saying that they don't condone abuse of any kind, especially in the presence of children, and that their hearts are with the children and they just want the safety for the children. They're not choosing a side or anything like that, or at least that's, you know, how it seems when you look at their social media posts. But at this point, obviously, it's no longer about one incident. It's ongoing. It's involving multiple events. It's a mess. And, you know, that's not even the only mess within that show. Now there's drama between Jesse and her husband, Jordan. And we're not getting into that because this is not that type of show, okay? We're going to move on to the next story. I'm going to take a quick break, grab a drink of water, and come back. And we're going to pick up where we left off. No more reality TV. Be right back. Getting dressed should not be that hard. And yet somehow, whenever I'm like trying to dress up to go on a date or do something fun with Austin, I'm usually standing in front of a full closet thinking, I have nothing to wear. And that is why I love Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy with a clothing rental membership that builds a wardrobe just for you with high quality, unique brands that actually make sense for your life. You take a quick 5-minute style quiz, pick items from your personalized closet, and they show up at your door in as little as 2 days. When you're ready for something new, you just swap them out and that's it. I've been using Armoire because my body, my lifestyle, and just my personal style have all changed, and buying new clothes every time just isn't feeling realistic. One of my favorite pieces I've rented was actually this white and blue dress that Austin and I went to a Teddy Swims concert. I wore the dress. I actually posted a video of us dancing at the concert and it went kind of viral. And I had so many people asking me where I got this dress, and I rented it from Armoire. And I'll also be honest, I've always felt guilty about how many things in my closet I've only worn once, if at all. Some things still have a tag on them, but Armoire completely changed that for me. I get to stay on trend, wear beautiful designer pieces, and then there's also like loungewear that I love too. I had this really beautiful floral Kate Spade wind jacket, like wind blazer. It was so cute. I wore it on vacation, got lots of compliments. And then when I didn't feel like wearing it anymore, you just send it back. It's so easy. Another huge bonus, Armoire is women founded and women led. They even spotlight women owned designers, which makes me feel good about where my money is going. So if you're struggling to define your style right now, or maybe your body is changing because of fitness or pregnancy or just life, Armoire is such a good solution. You can size up, size down, try new silhouettes, and swap whenever you need to. There's no commitment, no pressure, just clothes that fit you where you are. And somehow it's all designer without the designer price tag. Instead of spending hundreds on one dress that I might wear one time, I kind of get this rotating closet of high-end pieces for a fraction of the cost. Fashion math finally makes sense. It's not girl math, it's fashion math. One feature I have to mention is quarterly rentals, because Armoire is the only rental company that lets you keep favorite pieces for an entire season for just $10 a month. So if you find something you truly love, you don't have to give it back right away. And if you decide to keep it, then that fee ends up going towards the final purchase. You get to decide what stays for a month, a season, or forever. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.com. amire.style, amire.style/mama, M-A-M-A, to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today and thank me tomorrow. Lately, I've been thinking about how most of us are trying to be healthier, but we're honestly just guessing sometimes. We're taking supplements, we're following workout trends, saving wellness tips, and hoping something sticks. But what if the thing everyone's recommending isn't actually what your specific body needs? Well, that is why I tried True Diagnostic. They test your biological age, so not just how old you are on paper, but how your body is actually aging, along with key health markers like inflammation and nutrients. And instead of overwhelming you with data, they give you a really clear 90-day plan so you know exactly what to focus on next. So I took the test myself, and it was genuinely so easy. The kit showed up at my house. It was just a quick finger prick, and then I dropped it in the prepaid envelope. Done. I'm waiting on my results now, and I'm really curious about inflammation and my nutrient levels, especially with how busy life is right now. But what I like most about True Diagnostic is that it takes the guesswork out of wellness. It helps you figure out what supplements and lifestyle changes actually matter for you specifically, and which ones might just be wasting your money. They have a few options depending on what you're looking for. There's True Age, which focuses on longevity and how fast you're aging. There's True Health, which looks at your health right now. Or you can do the combo kit, which kind of gives you the full picture. No matter which you choose, you get your top three actions to focus on for the next 90 days, which makes it feel doable. And this isn't just influencer wellness stuff. True Diagnostic uses advanced epigenetic testing and is trusted by longevity clinics and health professionals. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, True is spelled T-R-U, diagnostic.com, and use code MAMA for 20% off today. You can choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase, or you can do a subscription. Now, if you're already spending time and money trying to feel better, this just helps you make sure it's actually working. So when you try it and when you fall in love with it, be sure to let me know. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing, homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day, you can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons. But you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com. All right. Now, I must say, before we move into this next story, if you want to skip the ads of these episodes, you can go to patreon.com/mamamystery. And for less than $10 a month, you can get all of my episodes ad-free. There's even some bonus episodes on there. So check that out if you're interested. So next, we're going to Michigan, where a mom has been sentenced to life in prison after her son died from untreated cancer. So this mother is Elizabeth Dubois. She's 43 years old, and she was just sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole after being convicted of felony murder and first-degree child abuse in the death of her son, Austin Raymond, who was 19 years old. The case goes back several years and centers on what prosecutors described as a prolonged pattern of neglect. According to investigators, Austin first began showing symptoms in 2016 when he noticed that something was wrong with his throat. Over time, his condition worsened significantly. Family members and others reported seeing a large, visible lump on his neck, along with increasing difficulty eating and speaking. By late 2016, his condition had deteriorated to the point where he reportedly could no longer eat solid food, and he repeatedly asked his mother to take him to a doctor. Prosecutors say that she refused, insisting that he was fine despite his worsening condition. At one point, Child Protective Services became involved and instructed Dubois to seek medical care for her child. Eventually, other family members intervened and took Austin to be evaluated, where doctors diagnosed him with chordoma, which is a rare form of bone cancer. Medical experts later testified that this type of cancer, while serious, is treatable and potentially curable if caught early. So prosecutors argued that Dubois failed to follow through with recommended treatment, delayed care, and made repeated excuses, including claims that she didn't have the time or money to pursue medical help. As the years went on, Austin's condition continued to decline, and by the time of his death in May of 2019, he reportedly weighed 83 pounds. During the trial, prosecutors described the lack of medical care as intentional and prolonged, pointing to evidence that that Austin had repeatedly asked for help while his condition worsened. After a two-week trial, a jury found Dubois guilty, and the judge later denied a request from her defense team to overturn the verdict and imposed the mandatory life sentence on the murder conviction, along with an additional prison term for child abuse to be served concurrently. So she is expected to pursue an appeal, but for now she will remain in custody as the case moves forward through the legal process. And this is one of those stories that gained a ton of engagement on social media. So let's talk about some of the top comments. The biggest question that I'm seeing in the comments is basically questioning CPS and why CPS is not being held accountable for letting him go without treatment when they knew about the situation. They were aware of it. And obviously CPS removes children from other homes, but in this case, they chose not to. And a lot of people are wondering why. And who knows if maybe she insisted that she would go ahead and get him care. But if there's no follow-up, and obviously now we have a child that died. I mean, I say a child, he was 19, but like at 19, I still think that you have a lot of tendencies of a child if you're subjected to parenting like this. So who knows if this person, if Austin even knew that he could have gone to the doctor by himself, who knows if he was even capable? I don't know. I don't know if he had any other kind of conditions that could have prevented him from seeking care on his own. But a lot of people are also wondering where the dad was. I can tell you that the dad actually passed away prior to all of this. And it was Austin's stepfather who eventually took him to an urgent care facility after the CPS investigator ordered the family to seek treatment. But by the time that he was seen by medical professionals, it was just too late. It was too progressed. It had gone on too long. And so regardless of anything, the culpability here lies with the mom not getting him seen sooner. Another one of the top comments is, why was he not removed from her custody? This was left by Shelly Bix. This is a great question and has 476 likes. So it was a great question that a lot of people are wondering. And I was wondering myself too. So I kind of just dug a little bit. And the only reason or excuse, I guess, I can find is that instead of removing him, the CPS investigator probably ordered Elizabeth and or her family to take Austin for medical treatment. And then there was supposed to be some sort of ongoing monitoring taking place. But by the time the full extent of Austin's neglect was established, he was nearing the age of 18. And that's how old he was when he died in May of 2019. And so I guess there was like legal delays, you could say. Much of the legal battle regarding his mother's neglect occurred during his final years and after his death. So I guess it's just the timing of it all. Also, I apologize if I said he was 19 earlier. I think I misspoke. I meant to say he was 18. He died in 2019. Sometimes I get my stuff confused. But anyway, Austin was an avid fisherman and hunter. He loved watching baseball. He was a big Tigers fan. His generous and helpful attitude shined throughout his cancer fight, often thinking of others first. He is survived by his grandparents and his caregivers, Bill and Brenda Carr, and Douglas and Deborah Dubois, who really stepped up and took care of him towards the end and tried to get him the help that he desperately needed. Unfortunately, it was just too late at that point. But I just can't imagine a single excuse for a mother not taking her child to be seen by a doctor. If it was because of money, rack up all the debt, bankrupt me, throw me in jail for not paying my bills, but I'm gonna get my kid the help they need. So there's just absolutely no excuse for something like this. And her smug little face and her mugshot, I have no sympathy for this woman. All of my sympathy goes to the child. Now, this next story comes out of New York City. There's a lot of talk right now about what the real cause of the deadly crash at LaGuardia was. But here is what's actually been confirmed so far. So the crash, this airplane crash, happened when an Air Canada regional jet was landing and collided with a fire truck that was crossing the runway. Two pilots were killed and dozens of people were injured in this crash. But this wasn't just one mistake. Investigators are now saying it was actually a chain of failures happening at the same time. So according to early findings, an air traffic controller had cleared the fire truck to cross the runway just before the plane landed. At the same time, the truck was not properly showing up on tracking systems because it didn't have a functioning transponder. That means that the usual safety systems that are supposed to alert controllers to a conflict did not go off in time. On top of that, there have been staffing issues in the control tower with limited personnel handling multiple responsibilities and reports of either missed or unclear radio communication between the ground and the aircraft. All of that combined created a situation where the plane and the truck ended up in the same place at the same time. Now, there is opinion going around claiming that the real cause is something bigger, that the entire aviation system is stretched way too thin right now and operating with very little margin for error. Which, given the post I made prior to this about the TSA shortage and the effect that it's having on multiple airports, I don't know if you've seen this, but right now there's like a government shutdown and the TSA is not being funded right now. So there's this shortage. There's either people quitting their jobs or just not showing up for their shifts because they're not getting paid. And the result is these super long lines at these airports where people are missing their flights. They're being told to get there not even just a couple hours, but like 4 hours in advance to ensure that they can get through TSA. A lot of people just aren't making their flights because the lines are taking so long. Some of these lines stretch outside of the airport and into the parking lots of these airports. So anyway, I can see how that argument could absolutely have merit. But as of now, investigators have not officially determined a final cause, and the case is still under review. I think this is a lot of things all at once. I don't know that only one finger can be pointed. I think just right now, everything is a mess. And I don't envy anyone who has to fly right now. All right, next we're going to move over to Brentwood, Tennessee. This is an interesting one because there is a video of this that I posted on our Facebook page, True Crime Kelly. So this is regarding the Reacher TV show and the star of the show, Alan Richson, who after a video of him fighting with a neighbor went viral, is finally speaking out, but not actually saying much about the actual fight. So he addressed the situation for the first time on social media, calling it a crazy week because this video was released that shows him physically fighting his neighbor in the grass, like on the sidewalk of this beautiful neighborhood in front of other children. And at first when I saw it, I was kind of like sickened about it because I thought, oh my gosh, these poor kids are watching their dad get beat up. I did not realize at first when I saw it that no, the kids are Richson's kids. Okay, so let me give you the full picture here. The incident took place over the weekend in Allen's neighborhood, and he was reportedly riding his motorcycle. And he had been confronted by his neighbor about riding this motorcycle too fast down the street earlier either that day or earlier that weekend. Now, according to the neighbor, the situation escalated when he confronted Allen again, and it is all caught on video, and the video is what I posted to the Facebook page, so you can actually go watch it. I can't just play the audio for you because it doesn't really explain much. You have to really see it to understand. But anyway, Allen rides his motorcycle up to this guy who's in the blue t-shirt. He's standing outside in the middle of the street, blocking him from passing. He literally like scoots over to stand right in front of the path that Allen is driving to stop him. He starts yelling at him and actually pushes Allen. And that is when things turn physical, because then Allen's like, absolutely not. I'm not gonna let you just push me. And he pushes the guy down to the ground. He is hitting him multiple times. And the video of the fight is actually taken. There's two separate videos. The one that I posted seems to be from like a GoPro that was stuck to Allen's helmet. But the other video that I originally saw was from a neighbor, like that looked like they were recording either from a Ring camera or like outside of their bedroom window. So all you could see was this guy attacking the guy in the blue shirt, and then these two kids sitting on their bikes, just kind of watching it all unfold, and they're just kind of sitting there. Anyway, the video of the fight shows him punching the neighbor multiple times while he's on the ground, and that is what caused the clip to spread everywhere because it's in front of these kids. After reviewing video and witness statements, though, police ultimately ruled that Allen acted in self-defense. So no charges were filed, the case is closed, and Allen, the actor, chose not to press charges against the neighbor. Authorities did briefly consider a reckless endangerment charge, but it was dropped once Allen declined not to pursue it. So right now, the situation is over, and all of this is to say it costs nothing to just mind your own business and stay in your own yard. The top comment on that post on Facebook is, one of them anyway, says by Jason Penny, funny how the media never showed the beginning of the fight. I'm with you, Jason, because my opinion of this case was very different before I watched the whole thing, which again is why context matters. Again, another comment was by Mike Cannon. I love how the kids are so chill watching their dad unload the whoop ass. It had 127 likes. It kind of makes you think like these kids kind of know what their dad's capable of and they trust him. They feel safe with his dad, with their dad, apparently. And then another comment by Cindy Holtzman. You never want to lose your temper no matter who you are, but the neighbor pushed him, not once, but twice. He owned up to it in another video. Maybe someone looking for some clout. Hard way to get it. I don't even think he got the clout. He got the smackdown of his life, probably. And now it's on video and on the internet forever. So again, mind your own business. Now, our next story takes us to Hawaii, where a doctor is currently on trial after prosecutors say he tried to kill his wife during a hike. And now she's taking the stand and detailing exactly what happened. The woman is Ariel Koenig, who is 37 years old, and she testified this week about an attack by her husband, Dr. Gerhard Koenig, who is an anesthesiologist. This all happened during a hike in Oahu to celebrate her birthday. It was literally on her birthday. Now, according to her testimony, what started out as a normal hike on the Palipuka Trail quickly turned so violent. She told jurors that while she was on this hike, her husband suddenly grabbed her and began pushing her towards the edge of a cliff. And then at one point, they were just feet away from a very dangerous drop that she was nervous to even approach in the first place. At first, she said that she thought he might be joking, but that quickly changed when he allegedly became aggressive and started forcing her closer and closer to the edge while saying things like, "I'm sick of this." She testified that he then pulled out a syringe and told her to hold still, which she knocked away during the struggle. After that, she said he pinned her down, was straddling her, and began hitting her in the head with a rock, telling her things like no one was going to hear her, no one was going to help, saying he's sick of this, he's effing sick of this, and just hitting her in the head with the rock. Now, at one point during the attack, Ariel said she tried everything she could to survive by physically fighting back. She bit him in the arm. She was grabbing him by the testicles and squeezing, trying to get him to release her, trying to break free. Can you imagine? I mean, her testimony, when she said that, I was just like, holy cow, that's such a visceral description of what she went through. And I can't even imagine having the frame of mind to try all of those things. But when you're in that moment and you're fighting for your life, I'm sure you just grab at anything. You would probably, I don't even know. But I'm so glad she did fight back, because at some point, two other hikers heard her screams for help and they intervened on the situation and were able to stop it. And thank God, because sometimes when you hike, you're like in the middle of nowhere and you just pray that somebody might be nearby to hear you if you fall or something. Let alone being attacked by your own husband with a rock and a syringe filled with an unknown liquid, but your husband's an anesthesiologist, so you can only assume the worst. Thank God those other hikers were there. At one point, she testified that she told him that her kids would, or that their kids, excuse me, they had two young kids together, that their kids would be left without parents, that he would go to prison and that she would be dead and that his family would be sad. And for a brief moment, she said he seemed to kind of pause and calm down a little bit, but it didn't last. She said that after that pause, he started attacking her again and that it only stopped when those two nearby hikers intervened and called 911 and helped her get away. So she was taken to the hospital with severe head injuries, including deep lacerations and trauma to her scalp. After the incident, authorities launched a manhunt and arrested Dr. Koenig hours later. The couple had reportedly been dealing with some serious marital issues, including what Ariel described as an emotional affair that she was having with one of her coworkers. They were sharing like flirty WhatsApp messages. And apparently Gerhardt saw those messages and since then was treating her like calling her terrible names. And, they were trying to work on their marriage. But I think at this point, you know, it was kind of towards the end of the timeline they had given themselves to see if they could make it work. And I think maybe Gerhardt knew it wasn't going to work and didn't want either her to take half of his wealth because he's a doctor, or didn't want her to move on. Whatever the case may be, he tried to kill her. But he is now pleading not guilty and claims that the situation was not an attempted murder, but rather that it was a fight that escalated and that Ariel may have been the one who initiated the physical altercation and that he was just defending himself. So as of right now, the trial is ongoing and prosecutors are presenting the case as a deliberate attempt to kill, while the defense is arguing that it was basically a domestic dispute that got out of control and he was defending himself. If convicted, which I think he will be, Dr. Koenig could face decades in prison. Next, we're moving to Highland, Utah. So much happens in Utah that I'm beginning to wonder if it's becoming the new Florida, but I'll digress. A Utah nurse has been found guilty in a case that centers around a years-long, deeply disturbing relationship between two friends and a plan that prosecutors say ended in death. Megan Sunwall, who was 48 years old, was convicted of aggravated manslaughter and obstruction of justice in 2024. In the 2024 death of her friend Casey Lynn Terry, who was 38 years old. So on August 12th of 2024, first responders were called to a home in Highland, Utah, after reports that a woman was unconscious and struggling to breathe. Sundwall was there when they arrived and told them that her friend had terminal cancer and did not want to be hospitalized. But almost immediately, things did not add up. Doctors later determined that Casey did not have cancer at all, despite having told people for years that she was terminally ill. Instead, an autopsy found that she had died from an overdose involving insulin, promethazine, and other drugs. According to investigators, this was not a sudden incident. It was something that had been building for years. Authorities uncovered more than 28,000 text messages between Sundwall and Terry dating back to 2019, In those messages, prosecutors say Sundwall repeatedly talked about ways that Terry could die and offered to help her do it. Some of those messages included statements like offering to give insulin repeatedly until it worked, or suggesting that she could help Terry pass while she was asleep. Prosecutors argued that Sundwall eventually acted on those conversations and injected Terry with insulin, causing her blood sugar to crash and leaving her unconscious. They also said Sundwall believed she would financially benefit from Terry's death because she thought she was the beneficiary of a $1.5 million life insurance policy. And there is the motive right there. But there's another twist, because that life insurance policy, just like the cancer diagnosis, did not exist. So then the case became even more complicated. Both sides agreed that Terry had spent years convincing people she was terminally ill, even going as far as to set up fake cancer treatments and convincing family members that she was dying. The prosecution described it as a vulnerable woman caught in a dangerous dynamic, while the defense argued it showed a pattern of manipulation and attention-seeking behavior. Sundwall's attorneys claimed that this was not a murder, but a suicide, and they argued that Terry had talked about wanting to die, had asked for help, like assistance in death, and had the means to take her own life. They also pointed out that the medical examiner initially ruled the manner of death as undetermined and not definitively homicide. But after Terry was found unresponsive, she never regained consciousness and died a few days later before she could tell the truth about anything that happened. Investigators later discovered that Sundwall had deleted hundreds of text messages, had searched for information about the life insurance policy, and those actions became a key part of the obstruction charge. So after about 10 hours of deliberation, the jury found Sundwall guilty of aggravated manslaughter and obstruction of justice. She now faces up to 15 years in prison and will be sentenced in May. Now, our last story of the day is in Crate Township, Illinois, where a woman is now facing multiple murder charges after authorities say she killed the father of her children and his parents in a case investigators are calling targeted. According to the Will County Sheriff's Office, Jenna Strubel, who is 30 years old, has been charged with 9 counts of first-degree murder in connection with the deaths of Jacob Lambert, who was 32, and his parents, Stacy Ford, who was 54, and Patrick Ford, who was 55. The investigation began around 2 a.m. on March 23rd when deputies were called to a home in unincorporated Crete Township for a welfare check. When they arrived, they found a disturbing scene. Jacob Lambert was discovered dead inside of a car in the driveway, while his parents were found inside the home near the front door. All three had been shot. Investigators say that Strubel and Lambert had an on-and-off relationship and had shared children together, which is part of what led detectives to focus on her early in the investigation. Authorities believe the killings were not random, describing them as a targeted attack, and that Strubel had made some incriminating statements during questioning. After the shootings, investigators say Strubel left the scene and drove back to her home in St. John, Indiana, about 8 miles away. She was located there later the same day and taken into custody without incident. Police also recovered a firearm that they say matches the weapon that was used in the killings, which became a key piece of evidence in the case. Additional details coming out of the investigation show that there had been prior law enforcement contact involving the couple, including a domestic-related incident in 2025 that led to a mental health intervention. So as of right now, Strubel is being held in Lake County Jail in Indiana and is expected to be extradited back to Illinois to face the charges. Now, at this point, investigators have not publicly released a motive, and the case remains ongoing as prosecutors move forward. But let's talk about some of the top comments in this case. Margie DeLorme says she killed them all because she knew if she only killed Jake that his parents would get custody of their kids. I know people that personally knew them, and I heard wonderful things about this family. This is just so sad. Another person, Sally Just, commented saying, "I knew Jake, and he was an amazing father. Still can't believe he's gone." Another girl, Elizabeth Ann, says, I went to school with her and she was always the sweetest girl. And then another girl, Kai Barlow, said, this happened by me. It's so sad. The parents went to my church. I feel so bad for the kids. So multiple people have come out and basically said they know both of them and have nice things to say about both parties. And it's just so sad when you see these domestic violence situations resort to something like this, like to go to the absolute extremes. And, you know, we've seen it, like we've seen it in multiple situations. And you always think like, get out, or there's ways to avoid it coming to this. But unfortunately, hindsight is usually 2020, and we can only wish that it was 2020 before it gets to this point. Now, one of the questions was, how do you charge someone with 9 counts of murder for murdering 3 people? That makes no sense. And I totally get why that's confusing. And we see this happen a lot with cases where somebody is charged with like 3 counts of murder for killing 1 person. And usually that's because the prosecution or the state intends to present multiple options to the jury so that they can decide on the murder that they believe happened, whether that's murder in the first degree, second degree, aggravated murder, whatever the case may be. They present a few different options, kind of like a menu of potential convictions. So with that said, since there are 3 victims, they could essentially choose a different charge or conviction for each of those victims. So let's say, for example, she killed him first and then decided in that moment, in the heat of the moment, she had to kill the parents too. Then, you know, she might face a more serious conviction for killing Jake with premeditation than killing his parents if it wasn't premeditated. I hope that makes sense. That's just kind of an example off the top of my head, but all right, I'm about to lose my voice. I have to go pick up my kids from school. So thank you so much for listening to this entire episode. If you've made it this far, I appreciate you so much. Share this with someone who you think might enjoy a true crime podcast or something new. If you share it to your social media, I would love you forever. Thank you so much for your constant support. And until next week, I'll be back with another weekly docket. If you want to possibly be featured on this podcast via a comment, go to my Instagram or Facebook. It's True Crime Kelly. I'm also on TikTok. And if you want to message me privately, you can do that through any of those channels or mamamystery.com. Have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay curious. Mama Mystery out.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.